We're on verse 13 now. Nirantaram bhasamane, nirantaram bhasamane, kutaste jnati rupatah, kutaste jnati rupatah, tad bhasa bhasyamaneyam, tad bhasa bhasyamaneyam, buddhir nrityatyanekada, buddhir nrityatyanekada, nirantaram Basamane kutaste nyapti rupatah tad bhasa, so it's tad bhasa basyamana iyam buddhihi nrityati ekada. Nrityati, shorty. Nrityati anekada. Okay. So continuing on with the drishtanta of the sabha, the dancing theater with, that has a dancer. Nirantaram means without any variance, continually, consistently. Basamane, that which is shining. Basamane kutaste nyapti rupataha. While the kutasta, whose nature is nyapti, consciousness, while the kutasta, whose nature is consciousness, is basamane, is shining continually without any change, means self-evident. When the self-evident, changeless, immutable consciousness is shining without any change, its nature being consciousness itself. So now, it's the top line. The word in this top line that's very important for us is kutasta. Kutasta, Brahman or the Atma, the self, your innermost self, is often called kutasta. Kutasta has two meanings. It's one that is steady or is abiding like an anvil. You know what an anvil is? An anvil is like a big, big solid piece of stone or metal that you can beat on like horseshoes, or you could, you know, shape metal by pounding on it. And as you're pounding on it and making things, creating things, the anvil remains completely steady, changeless. So no matter how much pounding and whatnot, whatever's been created on it, the anvil is there to remain as the steady adhishtana of what is being created on top of it. See what I mean? So sometimes the kutasta, as Brahman, is likened to an anvil because all of these changes are taking place without it going through any type of modification at all. It is strong enough to support and be like the adhishtana, the basis for all of that change, without itself being cracked or hurt or chipped. So that's called kutasta, the kutasta atma, the atma which is changeless, indestructible, which cannot be modified in any way. That's one meaning. And for many, many years, that was the definition, or that's the way that Swamiji explained this term, kutasta. There's another meaning that he started using later on, and the kutasta, both meanings are in the Shastra. You could take either meaning. Kuta means like magic or an illusion, right? So the one who abides there steady at the staha is remaining there in the illusion or in the magic show. So the kutasta here, in, if you think of the Maya, whole Maya, upadi, this whole projection of the creation, which we term as mithya, means that it has no independent reality. It is totally dependent on that one that abides in it as its very basis. So the Atma is abiding. So that's one. If we say abides in it as its very basis, that's more kutasta. But here we can use your own experience as a jiva, as this body, mind, sense organs. Here it is, the body is continually changing. the mind continually changing, the sense organs continually changing, the buddhi continually changing, the ahankara is identified with this and then this and then this, and the body comes in, takes birth and goes out of birth. So abiding amidst all of this change, this continual change, this coming into being and going out of being, abiding there steadily in this maya. Maya is sometimes translated as magic. Right? Just in Vyavahara, in empirical reality, the word maya, if I were just using it as a term for conversation, maya can be mean magic or an illusion. For us, we take the etymology in Vedanta, the etymology of maya, ya, ma, iti, maya. That which has no being, that which is not, that is maya. Means it itself has no being. So that which is abiding there, staha, abiding there amidst that which has no being of its own. So abiding there amidst the maya, which itself is mitya. Mitya means it is asat. It has no reality. It is in fact non-existent, except that we experience it. It's still non-existent, but we get to experience it. Because it is a beginningless manifestation or incidental attribute that belongs to Brahman. So Brahman has this incidental attribute that we call maya, and Brahman is pure existence consciousness itself. Right? In fact, just put the maya aside as an incidental attribute. When maya manifests, it manifests with space and time and objectivity and with the people and mountains and birds. It's its own little universe, this universe here. When it manifests, space manifests, time manifests, change manifests. Everything that we can say about this creation belongs to maya, the manifestation of maya. And so maya is something that manifests, is sustained, and goes back into what's that word I'm looking for? Unmanifest condition. Goes back into unmanifest condition. That means that time and space and objectivity, see or seen, go into an unmanifest condition, like in deep sleep. Okay? So that means that all of this time and space itself belong to maya. But you have to think of the dream. If you have a dream, the time and space comes with the dream. The jivas also come with the dream. So the whole thing exists within maya. Okay, so now, that maya is an incidental attribute of Brahman. It depends upon Brahman for the satchit, for its very being. Brahman is its being. But now imagine, just think of Brahman yourself, the conscious being that you are, without maya. If we're saying just Brahman, if we say just the word Brahman or the Atma, we're not taking into account maya. When we say Ishvara, we're taking into account maya, the one from whom this co-creation comes. But as far as what is actually here, we say Brahman. And Brahman, conscious being, which is your own self, is free of space and free of time and free of subject-object differentiation. And so, how big is the self? What size is your self? You know? How tall is it? How tall is it, you know? What color is it? These words have absolutely no meaning at all. Because when something is non-dual, there's not a right side or a left side or an up or a down, or black or yellow or whatever colors that exist. These things involve duality. They involve change. They involve dimension. You know? For yourself, there is no dimension. Because dimension requires space. And yet you exist, you are. So what we have to notice here is the nature of your own, if you, your own being, is itself free from dimension, and the incidental attribute, which means it doesn't bring about any change to your being, right? That this maya is an incidental attribute of your being, which itself is free of time and space, you know? From this thing, from the me that is sometimes called, I kind of like this in some more scientific language, that yourself is like an infinite point. And why that's kind of interesting is because a point takes up no space. It takes up no space, and yet the point is. And so, say if you think sometimes that yourself is like an infinite point. Why I like it is because when you're contemplating or just turning your attention toward me, you know, you can't conceive of space or time in reference to your own self-experience. It's something that totally transcends the concepts of space and time. And yet, you very much are. And so if you are just be with yourself without any focusing of the buddhi, without focusing outward at all into the creation, all there is me. Just this me which is here right now. It's not diffuse. Now, why I'm saying that? When you have a buddhi vritti, when you have a vritti, the sense of me in relationship to the vritti can be diffuse. And the reason for that is that wherever the vritti is, I am. So this is it's an amazing thing. Where, from the standpoint of the vritti, like say, if I have a vritti of this room, a thought modification of this room. So this room is so big, it's dimensional, it has a top and a bottom, and it has sides, and there are many things in the room and much activity going on in the room. Okay? And so when I just sit being aware of this room, I can say, yes, every part of this room is in my consciousness, and so consciousness, or me, tends to be viewed as diffuse in the sense that it's taking on the shape, or the shape itself is not at all away from consciousness. Right? So say I have an imagination of walking through a forest. That has the imagination has space in it. It has time in it. Even the imagination of you as a jiva has space and time. And so from the standpoint of that imagination, say if you imagine a forest and walking through the forest, every part of that imagination has sat, existence. It has being, existence, right? It is, it is, it is, it is. Every part of the imagination is known. And so it's almost as though your being has taken the size, has become the size of the imagination, right? Mm-hmm. And so you feel a kind of a diffuseness. This is me, this is me, or this is, this is, this is, this is, this is, this is, this is. And so that's magic. Because the one who actually has no space, has no dimension, has no time, is the one from whom this imagination has come. And the imagination can never be away from the self, which has no time or space, because there is nothing else but that. There's nothing else but that. And so it would have nowhere to go. There's no space there. There is just being, and being is free of space. And yet from this being, this incredible magic show comes. That's why they call it Maya. That which has no being of its own, but totally enjoys the being of my own self, right, is what we call, is what has the dimension, what has dimension and makes me seem diffuse, because I feel it. Or it can never, it's more like it can never be away from me. It can never be away from me. But, so when I meditate, I'm meditating. So I have to just give you this experience. Okay. Say I'm meditating, and I close my eyes, and I'm aware of my body. Okay, so I'm aware of my body. That gives a certain diffuseness to my self experience, because my body exists in time and space. And so as I say I'm aware of my body, I as though expand, as though to feel the size of the body. That seems like that. But now, if I sit with this, and I'm aware, say I'm just sitting there, and I'm aware of my body, then I'm feeling, I take the size of the body as though. But then if I turn just inward to myself, to my own being, just sit with me, then all of a sudden I'm not any size. So now, there is a viveka that has to be done between the me that has no size, but is just me, and the diffuseness of it is, it is, it is, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, which has to take place because when the universe, when the Maya expands with dimension, it can never still, it can never be away from me. And so I always, my being is always present, even if the universe is millions and millions of yojanas or miles across, billions of miles across, and inconceivable actually. Mm-hmm. There's no place in that infinite universe where the sat chit is not. But the sat chit, the me, has no dimension. And so I need to be able to recognize that. I need to recognize the fact that this whole infinite creation exists in conscious being, and conscious being, the me itself, has no dimension. And so that needs to be seen. The me, your me, is very, just very purely your own self. It's not diffuse. It's just the simple me. And it very obviously has no dimension. It is nothing other than me, homogeneous me. And so there is no time or space there. There is only one non-dual me that cannot be cannot be experienced spatially. And yet this whole universe that is infinite time and space and quality, that whole universe enjoys me, has me as itself, right? Because why? Because there is nothing else. That's why. Because there is nothing else. There's no other place to go. There's no space. There's just consciousness, which is free of time and space. So what size is that? Its size is not relevant. Why is this important? Because this, the me that is you, that has no dimension at all, but just simply is non-dual, is so, how to say it? It is nothing but me. There's no diffusion. There's no size involved. It's just very, very simply myself. And that is different than looking for an infinite me, or a diffuse me, or a me that pervades the whole creation. Then you're trying to find, okay, let me experience this infinite, spatially infinite self, or the self which is able to pervade through the whole creation, something which is not here. There's just not me at all. There's a significant difference between these two things. And so when we meditate, next time we meditate, I want to try to guide you again in a very specific way to just recognize the personal me. It is the very personal me that makes me me, and that is not diffuse. It's not that it doesn't swell into the form of the body, or it doesn't swell into the form of the mind. Say if I have a very huge vritti by looking up at the sky and seeing all the stars, that's a huge, huge amount of space I'm covering there. And it's true that that huge amount of space is never away from me. But I need to make a viveka between the me that is, has no space, and the space and the me that is going to be reflected in this huge vritti. It's a subtle thing. We'll work on it. But here, let me get back to this verse. So in this kutasta, the one who is always shining as pure consciousness, So the Kutesta, who in the Kutesta, that self which is absolutely stable as an anvil, who is this located, who is the very, who is abiding here in the midst of this Maya, in the midst of this magic show that we call Maya, whose nature is pure consciousness, in that Kutesta, then what? Ted Basa, Basyamana, Iyam Buddhihi, Mrityati, Anekada. There, by the light of that Kutesta, by the light of that Kutesta, in Basamana Iyam Buddhihi, this Buddhi, this intellect, this mind is shining by the light of that Kutesta, which is pure consciousness. So, when that in that Kutesta, which is shining uninterruptedly, just as pure consciousness, whose nature is pure consciousness, in that the Buddhi, this Buddhi, my mind, my intellect, it is shining due to, Basa's instrumental singular, due to the light of that Kutesta, due to the light of that consciousness. So I would say the Buddhi, which does exist within time and space, the subtle body exists within time and space, the Buddhi being Sattva is going to reflect that self. Mm-hmm. That self, the self, which is the Kutesta, the one who is existing free of time and space, is reflected in that Buddhi, which exists in time and space. And so the Buddhi, which exists in time and space, is located as though in the body, right now that we have a body. That Buddhi reflects that non-dual Kutesta that itself has no space. See what I mean? They're not... Why we're doing all of this is because of this word Kutesta. Okay? So Ted Basa Basyamana Iyam, that Buddhihi Nrityati Ekada. That Buddhi dances like the dancer. Nrity, like the dancer, the Buddhi as the like the dancer, it dances anekada in many, many different ways. Ekada would be only in one way. Anekada in many ways. That Buddhi takes vritti after vritti after vritti, is thinking about this, thinking about that, having this experience, having that experience. It is continually dancing in the light of that Kutesta. And because of that Kutesta, that consciousness, it itself is lit up because it is Sattva. It's like a mirror. Sattva reflects consciousness. So that dance, that Buddhi, which is continually dancing, continually changing, is illumined, is shining itself because of the light of the Kutesta, which is non-dual, which takes up no space, which is my own being. Okay? So now it says, let's do the next one. Now he's going to tell a little bit more about in this drishtanta, in this illustration, what does each thing mean in the illustration? So he says, ahankara prabhusabhya, ahankara prabhusabhya, vishaya nartaki matihi, vishaya nartaki matihi, tala didharinyakshani, tala didharinyakshani, deepa saksha bhasakaha, ahankaraha prabhu sabhya vishayaha narataki matihi, ahankaraha prabhu sabhya vishayaha narataki matihi, tala adi darini akshani deepaha sakshi avabhasakaha. Okay, so if we remember, especially for Peter and Bhavat, okay, I'm going to tell this the drishtanta, the illustration that we're using. But the whole chapter is called, it's called Nataka Deepa Prakarana. It's the chapter that deals with the light in the dance hall. in the theater, the light in the theater, okay? So here, in this sabha, imagine a theater where there's going to be a dancer is going to be performing in this theater. Okay, so we have a dancer, we have the theater, we all have also have the sabah. The sabah is the whole building in which there's going to be an audience and the person who is putting on the performance seated, in India seated right in the middle with his entourage, and then many guests are there to watch this dancer. So we have the people who are watching the dance, and then we have the sabah hall itself, and we have the one who is there putting the show on. And then we have the light that's illuminating the whole thing. It illumines the whole sabah, the whole audience, the people in the sabah, in the hall, the babu, the one who is the putting on the event, the dancer. All of these things are being illumined by the light. So here he's making an analogy of who's who in this example. The darshtanta is going to be Maya and my own self. Okay, so he says, ahankaraha prabhu. The ahankara is the prabhu, the one who owns this whole thing, the ahankara, that identifies this is me, this is mine. Right? So the one who, the ahankara is the prabhu. It's kind of the lord of the one who's putting on the whole event, right? The prabhu. The sabhya, the hall with all of the people in it and all of the audience in it, that sabha are all of the vishya, all of the vishyas, all of the objects, everything that is being objectified. So the sabhya itself is, and all of the people, sabhya, all of the people and all the audience, all of those people are the sense objects, sensory objects, sitting there in the hall. The nartaki, the dancer, is the matihi, is the buddhi, the nikbhasha. Mati means the mind. The dancer is the mind. So we have the ahankara, is the one who is the master of the whole event. The sabhyaha are all the vishyas that are being perceived. The nartaki is the matihi, the mind, which is continually dancing, continually changing, the buddhi. The taladi dharini, the musicians, the ones who are holding the tala, you know, the all of the tala, etc., all of the musical instruments, the tala, etc., the one who is holding that, those are the sense organs, the ones who are holding all of the instruments, such as the eyes, etc., all of the sense organs. The deepaha, the light, is the sakshi, who is avabhasakaha, who is illuminating the whole thing. So the point of this illustration is, the main point of it really, is in the illustration, the light lights up everything simultaneously. It lights up the buddhi, it lights up the sense organs, right? It lights up the sense organs in terms of all of the audience that fills the whole sabah. It lights up the ahankara itself, the master of the whole thing. This is me, this is mine. That ahankara itself is lit up, and then it lights up also the dancer. And the dancer here is the buddhi, the one who is continually changing based upon the changing experiences, you know. And how are the changing experiences experienced? Through the sense organs, through the sense organs in the mind. So as the sense organs, see the sense organs as the musical instruments. Mm-hmm. So as the musical instruments are playing their sounds, the buddhi is dancing to that. That's how they're making it. So the musical instruments are what allow the dancer to dance. The dancer is dancing to the music, right? And so here, in reference to this body, the sense organs are filling the buddhi with all kinds of input. And as that input comes in, the buddhi is continually changing. So the sense organs are feeding the buddhi, are giving shapes to the buddhi. The buddhi is taking the form of the tala and the instruments that it's hearing. And then all of that going on is only going on because of the sakshi who provides the consciousness. The sakshi is the witness. The witness, or the witness, is really just the chittabhasa. It's just consciousness itself. And so that one, because of whom the dancer is seen, right? The one who lights up the dancer, the one who lights up the sense organs, and the consciousness lights up the buddhi lights up the sense organs, the sense organs light up the objects. So the objects, so going backward, the objects, the sense organs, the buddhi, right, are all lit up by one sakshi, one consciousness, which is avabhasikaha, is the light which all are enjoying. So one consciousness lights up a lot of things at exactly the same time. We don't realize that. We don't realize that. Let me see if this next verse is... Let's do this next verse because then I can... These all are tied together. Swastana samstito dipaha. Swastana samstito dipaha. Sarvato bhasayet yata. Sarvato bhasayet yata. Sthirastayi tata sakshi. Sthirastayi tata sakshi. Bahiranta prakashayet. Sva sthana samstitaha deepaha sarvataha bhasaye yatha stira stayi tatha sakshi bahiranta prakashayet. It says, explaining it a little bit, sva sthana samstitaha deepaha, the deepa, the light in the sabha, the light is swastana samstitaha, remains seated in its own place. The light's not doing anything. It's seated there, stitaha. It's remaining. It's stitaha. It's remaining seated, standing, staying, swastana, in its own place, swastana stitaha, deepa. So the light remains there, staying in its own place. Sarvataha Basayet yata. It remains there, staying in its own place, lighting up everything. Basayet. Basayet sarvataha. Lighting up, causing everything in all directions to appear. It's causing it to appear because if the light is turned off, you can't see anything. So when we say appear, all of these things make themselves available, make themselves known. But they can only make themselves known because of the deepa that is shining upon them. So the deepa, the light, causes them to appear. That's why the causal. So this light, which is remaining in just one place, is making everything around it, sarvataha, appear, light up. So just as that's the light does that, similarly, sthirastayi tatha sakshi bahirantaha prakashayet. Similarly, the sakshi, consciousness, the chidvapahu, consciousness, your being, sthirastayi, remaining sthira, motionless. Consciousness is free of any type of motion. It's completely still. It's non-dual, right? It has, just think now, remember, conscious being is free of space. It has no space. It is, but it is free of space, and it is free of time. It is free of change. How can it move? If you remove space, if something is and you remove space, how can it move? Where will it move? There is no space. And there is no change. There is no time. So not only can it not move, it can't change. Once you take away space, there's no place for it to move. It simply is. You take away time, and there's no change. You can't have change without time. And so the sakshi, this me, is free of space, free of time. It is sthiraha. So sthirastayi. It is something that abiding firmly in its own self without any change. So it says, similarly, the sakshi, which is abiding without any change, sthiraha, bahiranta prakashayet. It illumines what is inside and outside. Bahi is outside, Antaha is inside. How does consciousness, you know, like the light that that shines all around, illumining everything, how is it that the Sakshi illumines what is inside and outside? So the question comes immediately, what is inside and outside? What do we mean, inside and outside? And so the next verse, let's do this, because this is all a section. Bahirantara vibhagoyam, bahirantara vibhagoyam, deha pekshana sakshini, deha pekshana sakshini, vishaya bahya dehasta, vishaya bahya dehasta, dehasyantara tarahaṁ kṛtihi, dehasyaṁ tarahaṁ kṛtihi. Okay, so bahihi means outside, so bahira, bahihi, antara, antaha, vibhagaha, bahira, antara, vibhagaha, compound. Ayam, deha, apekshaha, na sakshinaha. This is Marjorie's question. Na sakshini. Vishayaha bahya dehastaha dehasya antara ahankratihi. But this says, so he says, the sakshi illumines that which is both inside and outside. So the question is, what is inside and outside? So he says, bahihi, outside, external, and antaha, inside, vibhagaha, this division. So the division of inside and outside, bahir antar vibhagaha ayam, this division of inside and outside, deha apekshaha, is only in reference to the deha. It's only in reference to the body. You know, if the body has, the physical body has an outside, it has an inside. And so, it's a, and this idea, the separation of inside and outside, is only in reference to the body, na sakshini. Not in reference to the sakshi, not in reference to the witness. Vishayaha bahya deshastaha. Vishayaha, all the vishayas, they abide bahya deshastaha, in the outside space, outside place. All of the vishayas, all of the objects that you're looking at, those are outside. So vishayaha bahya dehastaha, dehasya antara ahankritihi. For the inside of the body is the ahankara, etc. So dehasya antara ahankritihi. That which the ahankara is inside. So it would be inside the body, really, is the sukshma sharira, the ahankara, the mind, the mind and the sense organs, the prana. It's looking inside. That's the inside. So looking inside, who illumines that which is inside the body? Right? The Atma. Who illumines that which is outside the body? The same Atma. So from the standpoint of the Sakshi, the Atma, is there an inside and outside? No. The Atma illumines the inside and the outside from the standpoint of the body. So that means actually the body, mind, sense organs, all of the inside, you know, exists in the outside. In the sense that, if I think of, or we use this example another class, if I think of the dream image, everything exists within, that exists within time and space is superimposed on conscious being. Everything that exists within time and space, which includes your body, your mind, your sense organs, the ahankara, all of your emotions, anything that is objectifiable, that exists within time and space. And time and space is, the whole time and space and everything in it is illumined by the Sakshi, is illumined by consciousness. We only call consciousness the Sakshi from the standpoint of what is being illumined. Consciousness is not a witness. It's not doing anything. I simply am, and the creation, you know, the creation comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. While it is there, it enjoys me. I am its adhishtana. Enjoys me means that I am its I am its basis. I am its sut. I am its existence. I am its knownness. So the Maya has no being or no distance from me. It is an expression of me, of the Atma, of the self, but it has no independent reality. So it's a different order of reality. This creation is a different order of reality from me. This creation has no independent being. I have independent being. I am what actually exists. It is mithya. It has dependent existence. It has no independent existence for it to have a relationship with me. It doesn't really have a relationship with me because I am it. It is me. It has no being apart from me. So that's a relationship with me, like me and my shadow, you know, or the relationship a snake has to a rope. If you mistake a rope for a snake, you say, well, there's the rope and then the snake, and they have quite a good relationship. They don't really have any relationship. There's only the rope there, really. So interesting, if I say they don't have any relationship, because one has no being apart from the other, so there's really only one thing there, and that Maya that appears upon it as though. So no relationship. There is here. So here, in reference to myself, what is the relationship of this mithya creation, which is illumined by consciousness? What relationship does it have with me? It is me. It's not a relationship. It is me. But from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, what relationship do I have with the creation? With Ishvara. From the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, this jiva, what relationship do I have with Ishvara? I have the relationship of a part to the whole. Right? I am the part, I am a part to the whole. That means that this little pocket of consciousness, this mind, body, sense organs, gets to walk through and be related to the infinite creation that we call Ishvara, recognizing that itself is only part and parcel of Ishvara. You know, just like all the cells in this body are part and parcel of the body. They are governed by the laws of the body. They belong to the body. They're governed by the laws of the body. They're taken care of by the body. And there are many different organs and whatnot in the body, but all of them are part and parcel of the body. Right? And so here, and governed completely by the laws of the body, belonging to the body, and enjoying the same sakshitvam of the conscious being that illumines this body. Right? So now think, this as a cell in the infinite body of Ishvara, you know, part to the whole. This body, mind, sense organs, belongs to Ishvara. So your experience of as a cell in the body of Ishvara, the experience you get to have of Ishvara, the direct immediate experience, is your prarabdha karma. Your prarabdha karma is just a little piece of Ishvara that extends beyond the body because you have limited knowledge. Your mind can't assume the infinite form of Ishvara. But everything that you do experience is only Ishvara because you are a part to the whole. And what is Ishvara? The expression of the one non-dual Atma, which is me. So in fact, I am Ishvara. I am Ishvara, and I am all of the jivas within Ishvara. I am Ishvara means I am the parts of Ishvara also. So like, I am the form of Ishvara, but not any of the parts. No, I am the whole Ishvara, because the Ishvara is an expression of me, of consciousness. The consciousness which is me. And so Ishvara is an incidental attribute, the Maya is an incidental attribute of myself, of conscious being. And so when the whole creation projects, the entire creation has for its being this one non-dual consciousness, which is me, which is my very self. And included in that infinite projection are all of the jivas that are only belong really to Ishvara. And so when we, as we gain this knowledge, this body, mind, sense organs, the prarabdha karma, everything is given over to Ishvara. Not as a gift. Oh, Bhagavan, I'm going to give you all of this. All of this which is already yours and always has been yours. So it is a gift in a way for that removal of ajnanam that makes me be this little tiny jiva, you know, that's trying to make my way in this inert world. That goes away and I recognize that this body, mind, sense organs is very much part and parcel of this world, is taken care of by this world, it's part of the whole, because the whole itself is a one interconnected whole that we call the Maya, the creation, that has one self. And that one self is the self of all beings. The one self is the self of the me, is the self of the entire creation, and it is myself. Myself is the self of the entire creation. And I can know directly, immediately myself. And that self that I'm knowing is the self of Ishwara and the self of all beings. So I know myself, and I know myself as the self of this body. I know who I am, how I am, what my nature is. And I recognize that nature is the very self of Ishwara, of the whole creation. And this body belongs to the whole. So it's more real for me to say, I am Ishwara, because that's the truth of it. Mm-hmm. I am Ishwara. I am Brahman, the conscious being, the Sakshi, the Chidvapahu, the pure conscious being that is me. And this me, from this me comes this Maya creation, which we call Ishwara. Why do we call this Maya creation Ishwara, the Lord God? Well, because it's a conscious being. I call myself a conscious being, and then I call Ishwara inert Mother Nature. But there is no inert Mother Nature. There is only consciousness. Nature itself is not away from consciousness. Rocks are not away from consciousness. The rug is not away from consciousness. There is nothing really. There is no existence apart from consciousness. So this whole creation is lit by me, but as a jiva, from the standpoint of the jiva upadhi, the sattva is thwarted, circumscribed by the tamas of this body and the limitations of the sense organs. And so even though I reflect the one non-dual consciousness, which is the consciousness from which the entire creation comes, from the standpoint of the jiva, I have a limited scope in what I can know because of the limitation of the body, of the mind, of the sense organs. I have limited experience. There's no limitation in reference to me as conscious being. That is full and complete because it's non-dual and doesn't take up space. I don't have to be big or small for that. But the very me that now is being experienced as me by all of the jivas is the very me that is experienced as the very self of the entire creation. So I can know, have direct, immediate knowledge of Ishwara in terms of Ishwara's self, because that is myself. And I can also recognize the relationship of this body, mind, sense organs to this conscious creation, the part of which I get to experience. And by infinite extension, I can realize that this creation is an interconnected whole of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part. And I can have the direct, immediate knowledge of the mityatva of this creation, that it has no being apart from consciousness, and I am that conscious being. And so I can have, in so many ways, direct, immediate knowledge, because what I'm working with to know is present here for me to know. Then I have to make some infinite extensions, which are logical, because if an object is objectified and exists within time and space, that puts certain characteristics to that object, which all objects will equally share. Which they are bound by time and space. And if they are bound by time and space, they have to be mitya, because they come into being and go out of being, and the object that I'm analyzing is infinitely divisible into infinitely smaller parts, all infinite regress. And so the mityatva of the whole creation can be understood by the mityatva of a part of the creation. My relationship to the whole creation is not necessary to know, because I don't experience the whole creation. I just experience this part, which is containing me, which is good enough. I have to realize that interconnected whole, the interconnected whole of the prarabdha karma that I find myself in. and let this part of Ishvara that I'm involved in terms of name and form, let this part, let me respond to it. As Ishvara keeps on changing, the story of Ishvara keeps moving along, let me respond to what is being presented to me. It's a lot different way of looking at your life than thinking that you have to create the life that's unfolding. It's much different when you think of it in terms of responding to it. And then Dharma plays such a big part. Antakarana Shuddhi takes on a whole different way of looking at it, because it's not about my trying to create something, even though all these opportunities of creating things come up and I respond to those opportunities. Yeah. But I don't have to create the opportunities. I'm given all the tools to create the opportunities in terms of response, not creation. They just take some meditation to see which came first. Which came first, you know? The universe that I'm responding to, or I'm recreating the universe that then I respond to. It's a really wonderful thing to contemplate. We'll do more later. Om Tat Sat.
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
So we'll meet at the tent at 8:15.
What is it?
We're gonna have kirtan tonight with singing bhajans.
Oh, okay.
With Mochen and also with Uma.
Can we ask a question? We were having some of discussion earlier today. Some mm-hmm. of us.
Right now.
Yes.
Okay.
Why did Maya come into being?
It never came into being. It's beginningless. Just as Brahman is timeless, its incidental attribute is also beginningless. We can say Brahman. We don't say that Maya is timeless, because when the Maya goes through the process of coming into manifestation and going, remaining and going into the unmanifest condition, but there is nothing to create Maya. If you go to that precondition of Maya, there's nothing to create Maya. Right? Because Brahman doesn't have any arms or legs, or, you know, Brahman is non-dual. So Brahman can't do anything to create Maya. And Maya's not there. If you say Maya's not there, it needs to be created. There's no time, there's no space, there's no arms or legs, there's no mind, there's nothing there to create it. And so Maya itself is beginningless.
But it's relatively here because we can experience Maya. So but the question was, why did Maya come into being? Could we just...
I know, but... Yeah, but that's a wonderful question and an important one. Because we are so contained within time and space. You know, and when we're contained within time and space, then cause-effect rules. You know, and there has to be a reason. Yeah. It's like saying, Bhagawan had to have a reason. He could have done a better job in a way. Why did he make this Maya that we all have to live in, and we're all bound by ignorance, you know, and all that, you know, and there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world. What kind of a God would do that? It doesn't make any sense. Why did he do that? Why couldn't he just leave us alone and let us just be one non-dual Brahman? Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. So you're looking for a creator, somebody who made a decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when you're free of time and space and objectivity, there is no one there to make a decision. Brahman, from Brahman's own standpoint, doesn't have a mind, doesn't have a mind or body or any duality whatsoever. It is just me, pure me, which is absolutely present right now. Brahman is not covered at all by this creation. It's incidental. It's just after it's mithya. That's why you can recognize your changeless self at all times, because it's the changeless me. There's nothing you can do about it. Nothing Ishwara can do about it. It's just who you are. So now you're looking for a reason for Maya to come, to begin. Why did Maya come? Why did this happen? And there is no reason. There's only, you get down to what actually is. Because once you go beyond time and space, there cannot be a reason. You're getting down to just the fundamentals. Like say you were to say, why is Brahman non-dual consciousness? What happened? You know, why did that happen? It didn't happen. There's no happening. There's only what is. Happening occurs within time and space. Then there's a lot happening. There's in fact, that's the Mandukya Upanishad. And we have to do this, finish this chapter. The last chapter. Any type of object goes back into a cause-effect relationship to an infinite regress. You can never get to the first cause, which means Maya. That's one incredible discussion in the Mandukya. If you can't get back to a first cause, then the whole thing becomes mithya. Right? And that's the situation within the universe. But at least within our period of time, we can say, well, this was caused by this, this was caused by this, this person made this decision, and this person made this decision, and this is all the things that happened, and we can come up with a whole network of cause-effect relationships. You can't do that when you're beyond time and space, and time and space belongs to Maya. Time and space belongs to Maya, not to Brahman. And so there's no one in Brahman in non-duality that's going to be the cause of anything. So it has to be as beginningless as Brahman is timeless. Because you can't say, when did Brahman create Maya? He never created Maya. And so you would say Maya is timeless in the sense that it was never created, and it's beginningless because it never had a beginning. Who is going to begin it? Where will it rise out of? What will it rise out of? What will the Maya rise out of to have a beginning? It can never rise out of something which has no parts, which is non-dual and is free from time and space. See what I mean? We want... I think it's a relief, actually, that this creation is just... It is what it is. It has its light side. It has its shadow side. Even it has suffering, it has joy and suffering, it has all of the opposites, you know? And so there's even a name for Krishna, the Lord, is Janardana, the one who punishes the Adharmis. They don't mean that some god in heaven is punishing the Adharmis. The creation itself punishes Adharma, you know? And the creation is Ishwara, right? And so the creation itself, the Dharma that pervades the whole creation, rewards, gives punya. Dharma gives punya to circumstances which protect you. Adharma gives papa circumstances which don't protect you. Right? But it's not like there's a God in heaven like, you know, look, she did a dharma. She did an adharma over there.
And that's simply because of cause and effect.
Yeah, the cause and effect is within the creation.
Within the creation.
Yeah.
And because we have... Like, can we say, like, because there's free will within
humans,
the jivas, human jivas, that because there's free will, there's a cause and effect relationship, and so there's going to be the negative and the positive and the reaction and all that.
You have the free will to bump up against Dharma, to make choices that go against Dharma, even though. I think what's so important to understand about Dharma also is that somebody doesn't really have to teach you. Somebody doesn't really have to teach you Dharma. it's something that you know always, just intuitively, instinctually, in reference to yourself. The problem is that because of self-ignorance, raga dvesha, you know, dharma gets put on a back burner in reference to other people. And the raga dvesha, because of ignorance, causes you to put that first at the expense of dharma.
Your own ambitions.
Yeah, because you think, my happiness, I need this to go to this party so that I can be happy, even if I have to leave my little child in the crib by herself for a few hours. She'll be okay with that. Let's go. You know, we do things because of our desire is so strong that it overpowers what we know to be right. But we get punished for that. Not that there's somebody punishing us. It goes against the creation. It goes against dharma, and that creates the experience of pain. You know. So we keep learning. And we can teach ourselves. Of course, all of the religions of the world and the spiritual disciplines, they all teach dharma and the things that human beings have learned over the Vedas are kind of a revealed knowledge, and they talk so much about dharma. But all of the religions of the world and all human beings go on learning, and pass the wisdom on. They pass it forward. So much wisdom has been passed forward to us because it stood the test of time. You know? This is what we've learned. Do these things, don't do these things. If you do these things, you will get in trouble. It'll cause a lot of pain for you. Try to avoid these things. You know, the Ten Commandments are like, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. Do this and do this. You know, because thousands of years we can just write those things off. But actually, if you analyze them, there's reasons that these things have stood the test of time. And that's why Swamiji wrote this book, Value of Values. Most of you probably have it. The Value of Values. He goes through all of them. In chapter 13, there's a list of about 20 values or so. What is it? Amani, Twam, Adambi, Twam, Ahimsa, Kshanti, Adajavam. And it goes on from there. So about 20 of them. He takes each one of those values and he tells you, makes you value that value. Why is that value? Why will that value stand the test of time through the centuries and centuries of human life? Is this value a value? And he unfolds that. Very beautiful. I get that even at CIS. I give that book that, you know, like in my spiritual counseling class, and sometimes even in the Eastern Theories class, I give them that book. They love that book because it does what it says. It gives you a value for value, a value of the values. It gives you a reason for following dharma, you know, a reason for never lying, for never being unkind, for never stealing, all of these things that we know, but why shouldn't I steal? Yeah. I have lots of money. Somebody gives these stories, you know, this guy had a neighbor who had stolen a lot of money. He himself was a thief. And he had hidden all of this money in the big safe in his bedroom closet. And so this guy, the neighbor, knew exactly where that money was. And he knew that he could go in and get that money. Probably never get caught. So he comes to Swamiji. This is Swamiji made up the story.
It's a story.
So this guy comes to Swamiji and says, Swamiji, I know this is not dharma, but I am willing to take the punishment. I know I can get this. Very almost certainly I will not get caught. Almost certainly. And so I am going to go and take this money, Swamiji. And I know it's a dharma, but I'm willing to suffer the consequences if there are any. What do you think of that, Swamiji? Do you think that's okay? Do you think that would be okay? We're ready to suffer the consequences. The thing is, from this guy's standpoint, the consequences he may be able to escape. He thinks he can escape the consequences. He's got a good chance of not being caught. So he believes he'll escape the consequences. But actually, even if he escapes and remains uncaught, there are still big consequences to be paid, even in the here and now, because your buddhi then has that stress in it of being found out, you know? And somehow, the way the universe is made, or Dharma is made, it won't leave you alone. You'll be running scared, you know? Mm-hmm. You're running scared, always having to cover up. Lying is another one, because a really good thing on lying. The problem with lying, it's very hard to remember your lies. Mm-hmm. Say you tell a lie to somebody, but you don't remember who you told this lie to and who you didn't tell the lie to. These things are going to create a lot of problems. Even if you look back in your own life, you can look at the lies you've told. I mean, everybody has their own little lies that we've told. And it would be your whole life would be much cleaner without those lies. It's called arjavam. A lot of purity, there's straightforwardness. There is no problem. There's nothing to hide. You don't have to say everything. That's satyam. Uma. They're standing outside, waiting to come in. They need to be able to come in. They're waiting for class to end.
He's coming.
We're just having a little satsang. Anyway, do you see what I'm saying? It creates a problem. It's better, they say, you want it always, the highest value in Hindu Dharma is to always tell the truth. But you don't have to say everything that you know, it's just what you do say should be true. It shouldn't be a lie. That's very confusing. So it's just very confusing. You can't remember the lies. You remember the truth because that's what actually happened. You can never remember all the lies and who you told this lie to and that lie. Very tough. Your mind is always jumbled. It never gets that cleanliness, that relaxation. All of the secrets. You have all the secrets.
When I was doing the whole cleanliness, I'm going to be a good girl. It was like something was hidden underneath and I could never access it. So when you say, if you do Sama Dharma and if the stress is with you and it won't leave you alone, like that's kind of what I wanted, was like to amplify it, to see what is this.
What is it so that you can resolve it? You have to bring it to consciousness, and you have to do some pretty pachabhavana or something, some prayaschitta, some neutralizing karma, a neutralizing karma to make up for that strain and stress that adharma is causing you. Do you know, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the 10 steps has to do with making yourself right with everybody in your past. So that's a type of pretty picture bhavana. It's just just any guilt that you're carrying, to be able to cleanse yourself of that through some type of confession. Even psychotherapy has its roots in the confessional. That's another whole other issue. But anyway, to get back to this lying, speaking the truth is one of the highest dharmas, satyam vada. May you speak the truth. But it's underneath that is what we call vak tapas. Speak the truth, but these are the things that you can say. You should say always what is true, but what you say that is true should hit them, be useful, helpful, beneficial, hit them, satyam, hit them, and it should be priyam, it should be kind. If it's not those three things, then don't say it. You don't have to say everything. Even if it's true, you don't have a license to just go around all of that saying all the things. Yeah. Swamiji says only to your parents and your teachers are exempt from that. Because some of the things they say to you, you may not like. It may be hurtful. But all other people, and a teacher is not The teacher does not designate themselves as a teacher to you. It's even important in understanding the word guru. A guru is not somebody. I am a guru. I'm walking around as a guru. That's not true. You're a guru for whom you are a guru, and the reason you're the guru is because you have removed their ignorance, and your acknowledgement of that makes them a guru. In India, guru means the one who removes ignorance, the one who removes darkness. So a guru is only something that is situational in a relationship. And even Swamiji would always say, in the teaching, say he's teaching 50 people and there's 100 people in the class, he's only really teaching each person individually. Not that he's going around saying, oh, now let me say something for this. But it's an individual relationship, and Ishwar kind of takes care of people getting what they need, but it's an individual relationship with each individual person. It's not a mass teaching. And everybody gets from it what they need also. Anyway, that was a little diversion from the Satyam Hitam Priyam. You should speak the truth, but only if it's beneficial and kind. Otherwise, just be quiet. Being quiet is good. But if what you say should be true to what you think and to what you do also. So that there's a straight line between your mind, your speech, and your actions. There's a straight line. Arjavam. You know? Nothing, no reason to have something hidden. I don't mean by things that are not said are not hidden. I don't mean that. But these secrets or these deceptions. Like even the first two values, Amanitvam and Adambitvam, in chapter 13. Amanitvam means, may I not have this Manitvam, means, say I have success, some successes in my life, or I have a lot of, maybe I have really a lot of money, or I have a lot of power in some way, or something that's relatively exalted. Then I need to let everybody know about that. That's Manitvam. I wrote this book and it was a bestseller. I was so lucky in the stock market that now I'm a multi-billionaire. You know, all the things that you say and other people are going to say, that's very nice. Very nice, very nice. Thank you. Whatever all you, you know. Don't say those things. Just be quiet, you know. See, Adambitvam is different than Manitvam. Adambitvam is different than Manitvam. Adambitvam is when, because of my insecurity, the example Swamiji uses is, say I'm going to a party that is really going to be attended by very wealthy people. And I'm poor. I'm poor. I don't have very much money. And yet I really want to make an impression. And so what do? I go rent a car. I rent a beautiful new car. I borrow some clothes. Or better than that, I go and dress myself at the best places imaginable, the most fashionable places. Get all dressed up, rent with my new car, you know, go to this party, and kind of hobnob with all the people, making myself appear to be much more than I am. Then after the party, I go back, I turn in the car, and take these clothes all back to the back to the store. Yeah, I take them all back to the store. I just wore them once. I didn't get any spots on them or anything. Them all up in the... Why would I do something like that? Why would I do it? Because look at the problem. This is just a facade, but you don't feel comfortable in yourself if you don't have as much you know, wealth or whatever as these people, or you're not as high, don't have as much rank, social standing. And so you somehow have to fit in so that they will think better of you. But they're not thinking better of you. They're thinking better of this facade that's walked into this party. Swamiji tells this story. I can't tell it as well. Oh, he can't. He really decks this one out in beauty.
The Angavastra.
Huh?
The Angavastra.
Yeah. Very funny stuff. Anyway, but these things, it's nice to kind of, like when Swamiji is such a great storyteller, when you tell it in kind of a story form, you really understand it and get it. And then you let these things drop off of yourself to whatever degree. We'll have all of them to some degree. But as you bring them to consciousness, then you grow out of these things. And then the mind becomes more and more free. As a person, you become more and more free, just relatively. You know, it's a big relief. So that Value of Values is a really nice book. You can still get it. You probably can get it online if you don't have it. Probably $4 or $5 or something.
Part of the iPad software.
Yes.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh yeah. So you can just get it right away. Yeah. Online, just online, just like that. Get iPad software. Yeah. Is that it?
Well, free will is as thou free will is. In my mind, there's no such thing as free. It appears as though we have free will, but in the reality, it's all Ishwara anyway.
It's all Ishwara anyway, and yet, I think it's more accurate to say it like this, because in a sense, there's free will, in a sense, there isn't. But we say, because if there's no free will at all, we're just automatons.
Yes.
And so that's not accepted in the Shastra.
Yes.
So what we say is that the free will itself exists in the Prarabdha Karma. So it is always entangled. There is no free will that is not incredibly conditioned by the Prarabdha Karma and all of your experiences. And yet, you can make a decision. Even you have the capacity to make a decision. You have the capacity to break out of it. Even though it's terribly conditioned by your Prarabdha Karma, which is going to be, you know, your birth, where and when you were born, the type of parents and siblings you have, the type of community that you lived in, all of these things, and the experiences that you had growing up, so much unconscious material is really pushing the mind or the free will in a certain direction. But the free will is there, otherwise you're an automaton. Swamiji once said, because this free will discussion comes up all so often, and legitimately so also, like how do we have free will and so conditioned? You can look at it kind of like a muscle that you can use. It's there to be used. Agnani doesn't really have to use it. I don't really need to use my free will because I'm here and responding to the situation. I'm not trying to insert myself into something that's not there. Kind of like that. But anyway, what he was saying, as you get down to it, in Maya, everything goes into infinite regress, and that's why you'll end up saying there's no free will. But on this level, you have to accept it as something that we have. Then he'll say, he's really thinking about this, and this is in one of those satsangs on the front page of Arshakulam. You know, there's all those satsangs. One of the satsangs is on this. He says, in the end, it's really where the really free will is in your prayer to Ishwara. That is free will. That's unimpeded. The prayer to Ishwara. Your prayer to Ishwara. Yeah, that's where there's the most free will. Because you're not really asking. You're not manipulating out here. You're just going to the source of the jiva, Ishwara. And to develop actually that relationship, that dialogical relationship between yourself and Ishwara is really wonderful, you know. learn how to tap, kind of tap into, talk to Ishwara and learn how to listen. Just like, it's just on a different level. If you do inner child work, you can talk to the little ones inside and you can listen to what they say. You can also visualize them. And it's really the unconscious producing the visualization, not your ego. You know, that just is taking place, and you can come into relationship with them. But in the same way, you can come into relationship with Ishwara. You know, where you are turning inward and talking to Bhagavan and listening to, like if you were to say, just kind of tune into to Ishwara and say, this is the situation, what do you think I should do? You know? And see what he says. See what comes. Sometimes it's astounding, you know? It's much better advice than you could give yourself. It's nice to kind of play with that, because we don't tend to give validity to our relationship with a kind of an internal psyche, the relationship with the psyche. You have to play with it to see that it's very, that there's a lot there to do and to learn, so that you kind of open up to the inside as well as the outside. And open up as a jiva within the whole, a jiva within Ishwara, both having just one conscious being, being one conscious being, you can get into a dialogue with Ishwara in whatever form you imagine him. And the Bhagavad Gita says, in whatever form you worship me, in that form will come to you. You know? Doesn't matter. And so what if you actually have a conversation, like a prayer with Ishwara? Do you get lots of different wisdom, a lot of wisdom? You have to try it. We'll be doing it in our meditation soon. We always do. It's part of the things to work on. Om Tat Sat.